Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts. I'm Andy Boyd. Today we're speaking with Minu Arjomand about her new book, Staged, Show Trials, Political Theater, and the Aesthetics of Judgment. That's a hard word. out from Columbia University Press. This book explores the public trials of the post-World War II period, alongside analysis of plays about trials from the same period, both in Germany and America. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the book, and it's such a great kind of window into this time period. Would you like to start by reading a selection from the book?
Sure. So let me read a section that's from a later chapter in the book, and it's about a performance of a play that was based on the Nuremberg trial. In the early spring of 1969, the former head of the Reichsbank, Halmar Schacht, traveled from Munich to see a play at Vienna's Burgtheater, perhaps the most prestigious stage in all of Europe. He sat in the very first row of the theater, face to face with a younger version of himself. The play was Trial in Nuremberg, and Schacht sat both on stage and in the audience. Schacht had been one of the few acquitted defendants at the International Military Tribunal in Nuremberg, but the play did not unequivocally exonerate him. When the curtain fell, Schacht lost no time in passing judgment on the play. He told reporters that the actor playing him was wonderful, mimicking him very effectively in both gesture and expression. And he was particularly honored that his character was played by Paul Hoffmann, the artistic director of the Burgtheater, as well as a successful film and television actor. Schacht also had high praise for the stage direction of the play. Outstanding, simply outstanding. The man knows what it's about. But Schacht condemned the playwright. It is a miserable work. The Nuremberg trial should have been fantastic material for a dramatist. The author, unfortunately, couldn't make anything of it. With a little skill, he could have used the material to prepare a wonderful indictment of the absurdity of the accusations against my person. As a crowd gathered around him in the coat check area, Schacht decided to make up for the author's lost opportunity to exonerate him. The author shows me in the wrong light. He wants to make the audience believe that I joined the Hitler government because of rearmament. That's nonsense. I wanted to tame unemployment. That's why I joined the government. You have to keep in mind that at that time, there were 6.5 million people out of work. And furthermore, in the 1930s, we had to rescue Germany from the communists. There were 230 nationalist socialist deputies against 100 communists. And so I ask you, who tamed unemployment? I was the only person in all of Europe who did it. At the end of his speech, one woman shyly approached Schacht and asked him to sign her program. Schacht leered. Aren't you afraid of me? But I'm a war criminal. Finally, someone who's not afraid. At the end of the impromptu performance, Schacht got one last moment in the spotlight, which he used to claim the legacy that he thought he deserved. When a reporter asked him who he thought was the greatest economist of the century, he replied, "Well, if you ask me like that, me, of course." Schacht used the Vienna performance of Trial in Nuremberg to try to rewrite history. There's no doubt that Schacht genuinely believed, there is no reason to doubt that Schacht genuinely believed that he was the greatest economist of the century, that supporting National Socialism was the best way to defeat communism, and that the charges brought against him at Nuremberg were a gross miscarriage of justice. But his version of history clashed with the history that the play Trial in Nuremberg presented, a history that emphasized Jewish persecution and the Holocaust, linked genocide with capitalism and imperialism, and drew connections between Germany's war crimes and the United States' war in Vietnam. These divergent histories were narrated and contested in the theater, both on stage and in the lobby, and the theater provided a public institutional space in which people could judge the evidence of such contesting historical narratives.
Yeah, that's such a chilling anecdote.
Yeah, it really is. When I came across it in the archive, I was really stunned just reading this account of Schacht and how completely unself-aware and self-righteous this former Nazi was. It's sort of nauseating, but at the same time, so fascinating to think about what theater meant as a public space at this particular historical moment.
Yeah, one thing that occurred to me when you were reading that, that I think kind of connects this anecdote to your larger argument, is that he uses this aesthetic judgment to kind of smuggle in a political judgment, where he says, you know, if the player had only had a little skill, he could have written a better play that exonerated a Nazi. You know, like what, like that's, I feel like that's kind of a theme in the play in general, the way the kind of slippage between aesthetic and political judgment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one thing that's pretty striking here is that Schacht does seem to be a kind of savvy audience member, right? I mean, I think that he, the way that he differentiates between the director's stage direction and the acting of the actors and the text of the play itself is actually kind of more sophisticated than what we might expect of a lot of audience members. And he uses that sort of sophistication, as you say, as a way to smuggle in this incredibly problematic political claim.
Yeah, I mean, he's almost a Brechtian audience member, right? Like, he's very able to criticize the play itself, and he's not taken in by the sort of illusion of it, right? He's very conscious of the stagecraft going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's one moment that it didn't quite make it into this section, but he tells the reporter that it's when he sees himself on stage that he realizes for the first time who he really was. But of course, he doesn't seem to realize anything about his culpability. Whatever he's realizing seems to be about, I don't know, how innocent he was, how persecuted he was, maybe. So if it is Brecht's theater, it might be a great example of the way that Brecht's sort of techniques might go wrong, right? That somebody actually comes away, has the sort of critical distance from the play, but then comes away with a very different idea than what the playwright might have wanted to convey.
Right. So this anecdote is situated in your book, which is kind of an overview of the intersection between trials and theater in a broad sense. And you point out in your book that trials have been part of theater since, you know, really the very beginning of at least Western theater, going back to the trial scene in the Oresteia. But that also there's this moment after World War II and for maybe about, you know, two decades afterwards where trial plays are a really popular theatrical form. Why do you think that was?
It's a great question. I think a lot of it just had to do with the politics of the time. this is a period that is really defined by its trials, right? So certainly all of the post-war trials, the Nuremberg trials, the Eichmann trial, the Frankfurt-Auschwitz trials. But even before that, international politics had been shaped by the Moscow Show trials, right? The Sacco and Vanzetti trial, and before that, the Dreyfus affair, right? And so this is a moment when trials become so central to public debates about justice and what it means for justice to be carried out. And trials become this very international phenomenon, right? Where people are following trials that are happening in other countries. And then for the first time, we have an international trial. We have what Brecht described as the first time that a country is being held to account in a court of law for its crimes, right? This is how Brecht described the Nuremberg trials. And so for this reason, I think this was also a moment in which trials were really front and center in the popular consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just, I mean, there are a lot of plays that are dealing explicitly with these trials, with the trials related to the Holocaust. But, you know, when I started to think about famous trial plays, I feel like they're almost all kind of in this period. You know, whether it's Inherit the Wind or To Kill a Mockingbird, the stage adaptation of that book. I mean, it really does seem like the idea of using theater as a place to kind of enact judgment is you know, really in the air. I want to ask a sort of, you know, maybe a excessively nerdy theater history question, but do you think there's a way that we can see this as sort of the, like, I don't know, the furthest possible extension of something like Shaw's argument in The Quintessence of Ibsenism, that what makes modern drama distinctive is that it involves, you know, debate and discussion, and these are plays that are, you know, all debate and discussion?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. But I think that they read as being all debate and discussion. One of the things that I found as I began to look through the archival materials about these plays is that they did range a lot in the ways that they were actually produced, right? And so, for example, Ervin Piscator's production of Peter Weiss's play, The Investigation, which was based on the Frankfurt-Auschwitz trial, which was a really key moment in Germany because this was the first time that functionaries at a concentration camp were charged for their crimes. And so Piscator's production of this play, based very closely on the proceedings of the trial, had this incredibly overwhelming sound design that was created by Luigi Nono, himself a very important composer at the time, that by all accounts, the volume was incredibly loud within the theater. It is a very creepy sort of sound design. You hear sort of distorted sounds of people screaming, the voices of children, sounds that sort of sound like gas. And so on the one hand, reading the text of the play, The Investigation, it is absolutely all about debate and discussion. But I think that for audiences who were in that performance, there was this other component that was maybe a more visceral one.
Yeah. And one of the things I found fascinating about the book is that you kind of suggest that because, you know, these are plays, like plays are harder to censor than novels or poetry or something, because there's always that indeterminacy of the live performance, how it's going to be directed, how it's going to be acted. And this means that, you know, documentary theater can be a very slippery medium where plays could be put to very different uses than what the author perhaps intended them to be used for, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And that was completely the case with this play, Trial in Nuremberg, the one that Schacht went and saw, because it was actually first performed not in Vienna, but on the other side of the Iron Curtain. It was first performed in East Germany. There, it was actually subject to the censors, and there are descriptions of the sort of, gentle but probably absolutely mandatory suggestions given by government officials who would attend the rehearsals. And the really fascinating thing is that when it was performed in East Germany, this play based on the transcripts of the Nuremberg trials was really used as a way to think about West German rearmament that was happening at the time, to condemn the US's war in Vietnam, and also from in a way to criticize the East German regime's narrative about the Second World War, which really excluded the Holocaust from that story. That story was all about the anti-fascists and the fascists and the sort of racial persecution that was so central to National Socialism was erased. So within the original production in Berlin, the playwright Ralph Schneider is doing this sort of complicated dance where on the surface, he makes this play look like it's actually a condemnation of the US and West Germany. He does smuggle in, though, some sort of implicit criticisms of East Germany. Then it travels from this original production in East Berlin to a new production in Vienna, in which actually, there unfortunately isn't a video recording of it, but I did listen to an audio recording, and Schacht is kind of made out to be this very sympathetic character. The audience often laughs at the sort of witticisms that Schacht delivers while on stage. It's clear that the whole framing of the play was very different from what Ralph Schneider intended in the original East German production. So we absolutely, one of the things that interested me in looking at these plays is the way that their politics shift through both stagings and through the way that they're performed. Another quick example would be Irvin Piscator's production of Arthur Miller's The Crucible, right, which within the U.S. context is about the House on American Activities hearings and McCarthyism. But when Piscator produces it in Germany, it actually becomes a play about primarily about racial persecution, right, and about anti-Semitism. So I'm really fascinated in the particular capacity for these trial plays to also put on trial different sorts of issues and constellations as they move and are produced in different places.
Right. I mean, you know, in a way you would think that theater would maybe not be the ideal form to create something that's kind of trying to represent some kind of objective truth, right? I mean, you know, why wouldn't you just make a documentary film? Like, that would seem to be, you know, much, much more, authoritative or something. Mm-hmm. Why did these plays have to be plays?
I think that's an incredibly important point, right? That one of the things about theater and about playwriting in particular is that you lose control over it. This is actually even a point that Hannah Arendt makes when she writes in The Origins of Totalitarianism about the initial run of Brecht's Three Penny Opera in Berlin. And she writes that this is an example of the way that the writers, directors, producers of a play can never fully control its meaning. Because when she went and saw the Three Penny Opera, the room was full of the very sort of capitalists who Brecht is condemning. And for them, they thought it was a fantastic time. For them, Brecht's message that capitalism is itself structurally a criminal gangster-like enterprise was one that they actually thought was great. They love to be compared to gangsters and criminals, right? They actually embrace that. And this is Arendt's description of it. And so, yeah, if even the Three Penny Opera can be seen as a celebration of capitalism, what hope is there for theater to deliver any sort of message? And my answer here is actually really similar to Arendt's, where paradoxically, it is this very capacity of theater to change the world in ways that weren't initially foreseen that make it the most political art form. Arendt's political theory is in a way very frustrating because she argues that any action that people take is immediately intertwined within this net of other actions. We can never know what the ultimate result of an action will be, right? But all we can keep doing is to keep acting within this world of other people, right? Because for Arendt, freedom actually isn't doing what you want and creating something and having it be out there in the world. Freedom for her is defined as the space between people, right? The conflicts between people, the negotiations between people. And so this is a roundabout way of getting to your answer, but the challenge is that it's precisely because these plays can be so radically reinterpreted against the intentions of the playwright or the original director that they are so important to political discourse, right? That's what defines political discourse itself.
Right. It's not that theater is a particularly efficient sort of way to transmit a message from one brain to another, but that it's the act of watching plays is itself an act of kind of democratic deliberation, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Great. I want to talk a little bit we've kind of been ranging pretty broadly throughout the book, but you do organize it into chapters that are primarily about these three figures, these kind of three key figures. And you've already talked about Hannah Arendt, who's a theorist I don't think people often kind of think about in the context of theater history. Correct me if I'm wrong, but why did you begin your book with her, and what is the importance of theater for Arendt? I know you've already started to talk about this a little bit, but I'd love to, if you could kind of go more in depth about, you know, what for her is, for example, the importance of a trial itself being a type of theater. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Arendt is, I think, very profoundly influenced by contemporary theater. She knew Brecht, her first husband, actually worked closely with Brecht, and she writes a great deal about theater, actually, though, strikingly, her analysis of theatricality and politics is generally just interpreted in relation to classical Greek theater. So Arendt writes a lot about the Athenian polis and Athenian democracy. And so work on Arendt has tended to focus on, when it focuses on theater, on this sort of imagination of Greek theater. I think, though, that if we understand her work in conversation with the contemporary theater of her day, which she was absolutely following and attending, it gives us a very different sense of what she means when she talks about theater. And of course, this comes out, I think, first and foremost in her account of the Eichmann trial, Eichmann in Jerusalem, which is probably her most controversial work. And so a lot of critics have taken objection with Arendt for calling the Eichmann trial a show trial, for talking about the theatricality and criticizing the theatricality of the trial. And I think one thing that comes out when you really actually look at her interest in contemporary theater is that she's criticizing not so much theatricality per se, but a particular type of theatricality within the Eichmann trial. So her concern with the Eichmann trial is that it, if we want to use Brecht terms, that the Eichmann trial presents a sort of Aristotelian drama, right? That it's structured in such a way that it makes the Holocaust, it presents the Holocaust as the inevitable outcome of millennia of anti-Semitism in Europe, that it seeks to create some kind of catharsis in those who are watching it that will create a new sort of national identity that will specifically further a nationalist agenda within Israel. And what she says is actually that theater is really important to the trial. She has a line where she says, for justice to be done, it must seem to be done, right? But the kind of theater that she's looking for is not an Aristotelian theater. It's not a theater that's about inevitable fate and about catharsis. She's calling very much for a Brechtian theater, for an epic theater, right? In which people attending the trial would be constantly asked to critique the sort of narrative that's being presented to them, right? And being asked to think about whether the Holocaust was inevitable, and to think about how Eichmann also could have acted differently, right? Because ultimately for Arendt, the problem with this sort of the way that the trial was staged was not that it condemned Eichmann. She actually thought that it let Eichmann off too easily because it made his actions seem like this inevitable part of history, where she wanted to actually focus on the ways that he could have acted differently, right? That any individual German soldier actually could have said no, and could have not obeyed their murderous orders. I think that reading Arendt in relation to contemporary theater absolutely can make us understand her political theory in a richer way, and particularly understand what it means when she talks about acting and action in the public sphere.
Right, because it's not this idea that saying something is theatrical is the same as saying that it's fake or artificial, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then I'm totally convinced that there's like a sort of an influence here, but this idea of kind of the radical contingency of history does seem very Brechtian to me. I want to ask, though, are you making a more or less straightforward influence claim that, you know, Arendt is influenced by Brecht, or is it more a kind of spirit of the times type of argument?
I think it's maybe more a spirit of the times argument. I also think that both Arendt and Brecht are very deeply influenced by Walter Benjamin. And I think that a lot of this idea of history is also coming from Benjamin. And though Arendt and Brecht weren't very close to each other, both of them individually were very close to Benjamin. And so I think there's also his influence there.
Benjamin seems to have been close to pretty much everybody.
Yeah, I mean, he just seems like a wonderful sort of teddy bear of a guy in general. Right.
Yeah, I don't remember what this original example was, but Tony Kushner somewhere writes about, gosh, I think it's Melville. He says, like, you can't read Melville without kind of falling in love with him a little bit. And I feel that way about Benjamin, too. You're just like, he just seems like a good, smart, interesting, funny guy.
Absolutely.
You know, a tangent. I get the sense, you know, this is like getting a little bit outside of the scope of your book, but I sometimes get the sense reading Benjamin on Brecht that Brecht didn't fully know what he was doing until Benjamin explained it to him. Like that Benjamin's sort of summaries of what Brecht's epic theater meant are like so much more, you know, lucid and persuasive than Brecht's own writings sometimes.
Yeah, no, I mean, I find myself assigning Benjamin's What is Epic Theater probably more to my students than Brecht's own theories of theater. You know, Arendt would also have something to say about that, which is that it's, for Arendt, it's the storyteller who afterwards can give the best account of a person's life, even better maybe than they could give it of it themselves.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to transition to talking about your chapter on Brecht. Earlier, you kind of mentioned this sort of strange way that plays, you know, kind of have their own life after they leave the playwright. And this is even true of Brecht, right? That that Brecht is a playwright who directed at least the first productions, I think, of all of his plays, or if not all, at least definitely the majority. And yet there's still this sense, I mean, you relate a conversation he has in rehearsal for one of his plays where, you know, somebody says, well, don't you mean this by this line? And he says, no, we can't know what the playwright meant. We just have to interpret, you know, for ourselves what this mysterious playwright meant, this sort of bifurcation between Brecht, the playwright, and Brecht, the director. And yet you also point out that Brecht compiled these sort of very extensive notebooks for how to stage the plays so that people could essentially replicate his staging of it. So he's kind of, you know, insisting on the separation between playwright and director, while at the same time he's saying, you know, if you're going to stage my play, you really should stage it in this incredibly specific way that I staged it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a great example of sort of Benjamin being maybe a better Brechtian than Brecht himself is. He, I think, talked a really good game about democracy, but as we know, not only did he run his rehearsals in a very authoritarian way, but he routinely wouldn't credit particularly his women collaborators. And so, you know, there's Brecht as this sort of eminently democratic theorist of theater, but the actual Brecht in practice was a very different historical person.
When you talk about Brecht as autocratic in the rehearsal room, I wonder, you know, what exactly you mean by that, because it seems on the one hand, like it's very clear that kind of what he said went, but it wasn't as clear to me reading the book that, you know, these were, you know, tense or kind of emotionally abusive rehearsal rooms like we've maybe encountered, you know, from certain directors. I mean, do you get the sense that being in the rehearsal room with Brecht was, you know, an environment that brought out the creativity in his collaborators, or did it, do you think it felt you know, stuffy in that authoritarian way? Or is it, or was he able to create the illusion that everyone can contribute while actually just getting his way in the end?
Mm-hmm. I mean, on the one hand, of course, it's fundamentally unknowable. I'm sure that also different people experience his directing in different ways. I think probably gender would have a lot to do and would pretty profoundly shape how you experienced him as a director. But I do think that what you're describing, the sort of maybe authoritarianism, but that also maybe feels sort of good and that you might go along with, is also a really good description, actually, of Brecht's relationship to the East German regime. And I think that that relationship, and when we think about East Germany and Brecht's really ambivalent relationship to it, is maybe a good example or analogy on the political level of what rehearsals in Brecht's studio would have been, right? That maybe it's not democratic. Maybe you don't agree with everything, but it's perhaps the best bulwark that you could feel against fascism, and the resurgence of fascism, which was absolutely how Brecht felt about the East German regime. He supported it, even though he also had some big problems with it. And I can imagine that it might have felt similar to be an actor within Brecht's theater, right? That not everything is great, but that it's maybe the best political alternative.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so fascinating to me how immediately the Holocaust and the Nazi regime become sort of a cudgel that both East and West Germany used to beat the other one with, right? That like, it's true that there are certainly authoritarian elements of the East German regime, and it's also true that there are high-ranking Nazis in the West German regime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And so it seems like you really have to read, you know, Brecht really starting in 1945 as being a sort of Cold War a playwright, and that's a very tricky place for someone who, you know, is a kind of unorthodox Marxist in the way that Brecht was. Mm-hmm. Always kept a West German passport, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I think that this really comes to a head, right, in the East German uprising. And Günter Grass's The Plebeians Rehearse the Uprising, I think, is a sort of a very cynical take on Brecht at the time, but also just a fabulous play about what that really ambivalent complicity with the regime might have looked like, right? And I don't think that we can underestimate just how possible it would have seemed to Brecht in the 1950s that fascism would come back in Germany, right? And so I think that this context, of course, now within our current context, we maybe are seeing that possibility more strongly than we have in many years, not in Germany, but in the United States, though perhaps in Germany also to a lesser extent.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I had a conversation with one of my friends who's an anarchist a while ago, and I sort of casually said, well, you know, the fascists have never actually won in America. And he said, what are you talking about? The fascists have never lost. There's a real sense, at least, you know, in the American Communist Party, that fascism might be, you know, just around the corner in the United States. I mean, you write about Brecht sort of theatricalizing the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings, but then leaving immediately afterwards. Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't think that he's fooled them by, you know, and I love the description in here of, you know, some House member reading one of his very fiery Marxist poems and saying, did you write this? And he says, well, no, that's a pretty bad translation. That really distorts my meaning quite seriously. Yeah. There's this sense of irony, but also he's very aware that he's in serious danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he and also actually Irvin Piscator, who wasn't called, but who left the States, you know, knowing that there was an FBI file on him, he would have eventually been deported, I'm sure, had he not left. You know, these are people whose lives were defined by being refugees and by being stateless, right? And so I think keeping as many passports as you possibly could was not just a marker of privilege. It was a matter of survival for them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you could understand how if you'd been close to Benjamin, you would want to keep your options open.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've just given me a lovely opportunity to transition to Piscator, but I do want to ask, you know, one more question about Brecht before we do. Which is, I forget who you quote, but you say somebody wrote that every Brecht play could be called The Trial, which I thought was a great line. What did you mean by quoting that line, and what is the importance of the form of The Trial for Brecht?
Yeah, well, for Brecht, epic theater in general really seeks to turn the theater into a courtroom, right? The audience is continually being asked to not just go along with what's happening on stage, but also to judge what they're seeing in front of them. Brecht is also trying to provide the audience, especially in his learning plays, with the sort of tools that they'll need to judge both what's happening on stage, but then what's happening in the world around them when they leave the theater. And finally, trials are really the key narrative moment. Almost all of Brecht's plays include a pivotal trial scene, right? So if you think of The Good Person of Szechuan, where there's the judges sit in trial over Shente at the very end, or you think about The Measures Taken, which the entirety of the play is structured as a trial. Trials are both this kind of key narrative aspect on stage, but they're also the model for his theater. And since Brecht is so into being self-reflexive about everything, of course, having the trials take place on stage is a way of reflecting back on what judgment means and what judgment looks like, and especially what judgment doesn't look like, because most of the trials that are in Brecht's plays are supposed to be really bad and unjust trials that make the audience then think about how unjust trials within their own systems outside of the theater are.
Right. He's like sort of putting trials on trial, maybe.
Yeah. And often when he has the trials on stage, like in Man is Man or The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahogany, there's also an onstage audience that's treating the trial as though it's sort of a boxing match, right? The onstage audience is always drunk and rowdy and right. calling for blood and just sort of the prime example of what audiences at trials shouldn't be.
Right. But sort of what audiences at Brecht's plays should be, right? Doesn't he somewhere mm-hmm. say that he wants people to be, you know, smoking a cigar and shouting mm-hmm. at the stage while they're watching the plays?
Yeah. I think that for Brecht, maybe cigars are good, but being drunk is bad.
Okay, right? that's the line.
So it's like you want to have distance, you want to have critique, you can get a little bit rowdy, but you need to maintain these rational capacities. And it's the sort of drunken, frenzied audiences on his stage that don't have that.
Yeah. All right. Let's transition to talking about Piscator. I think that probably most of our listeners will have a basic familiarity with Arendt and with Brecht, but Piscator is, you know, still less well known than probably he deserves to be. So what was Piscator's importance to German theater, and what is his importance to your larger argument about the place of trials in theater?
Mm-hmm. I mean, as I was working on this project, I sort of started to feel about Piscator the way that you described feeling about Benjamin, which is just, you know, this is someone who is kind of always really... just seems like a good guy, you know, and is right. really struggling to formulate an idea of political and a practice of political theater that will just intervene in whatever is happening at the moment that he's working. So I think one of the big, or a few of the big differences to Brecht is first that Piscator is a stage director and a producer rather than a playwright, though he does do some playwriting in the sense that he collaborates on creating these documentary plays, but he's not writing dramatic theater in the way that Brecht is. So I think that's a big reason why today it's Brecht who we associate with epic theater rather than Piscator, just because as much as we all love and want to focus on performance, our understanding of theater, particularly in this period, is still so much structured around texts rather than staging practices. And the other thing that's fascinating about Piscator is that, I mean, he lived a bit longer than Brecht, and he really radically changes his practice of directing, both based on political circumstances, but also based on his sort of location, the culture around him. Brecht's theories of epic theater don't change all that much throughout his life, which is pretty striking because he articulates them in the Weimar Republic, or at the very end of the Weimar Republic. He has these theories while he's living in Hollywood. He brings these theories back to East Germany, all completely different political situations. Because Piscator is working as a stage director, I think that gives him a much closer relationship to to just social interactions, to the cities that he's in. He is working in Berlin and running a theater that he's closely aligning with the Communist Party. Unlike Brecht, he was a member of the party at the time. He's staging these sort of tremendous rally performances that are very much in line with the sort of historical avant-garde, that are using all of these techniques of agitprop on a huge scale. And then he goes to New York and he's working at the dramatic workshop with Stella Adler, right? And mm-hmm. all of a sudden he's in this situation where he's also teaching students psychological realism in their acting, right? And of course, to an extent, his politics, he can't express his politics in the same way in the States, right? And I think it's because he is teaching in New York, and particularly because he also is teaching a relatively racially diverse group of students. Harry Belafonte is one of his students, that he becomes more and more concerned, not just with class politics, but also with questions about racism and anti-Semitism. Brecht, because he's not really working day to day in a theater in Hollywood, I think his analysis of fascism very much stays where it had been in the Weimar Republic. It stays as the sort of class-based understanding of what's happening of fascism and Nazism in particular as just being the sort of ultimate culmination of capitalism. Piscator, I think because of his work in New York in a theater, begins to be concerned with questions about race, with questions about anti-Semitism. Neither of them are ever in their theoretical writings very concerned with gender, though I think Brecht, despite himself, writes some of the best feminist plays out there. And then when Piscator moves back to West Germany, he is incredibly concerned with thinking about the Nazi past and with developing a new form of theater and fostering this documentary theater that would hold Germans to account in a way that at the time very few institutions were. Piscator is really fascinating to me as someone who manages to really change and adapt and rethink what it means to make political theater, and who also, interestingly, connects the moments of the historical avant-garde with the 1960s documentary theater.
Right, so there's a real chain of influence there. It's not a coincidence that these kind of living newspaper plays become, you know, current again in the street theater of the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go
ahead.
I want to hear what you have to say, and then I'll ask my question.
Well, I was just going to say quickly, of course, through the dramatic workshop, we can see the sort of American theater of Marlon Brando and Tennessee Williams, who were students there, neither of whom actually graduated. But of course, also Judith Malina and Julian Beck were there. So from the dramatic workshop, we can also trace these two sort of very radically different traditions of American theater. On the one hand, the sort of mainstream Broadway psychological realism, but on the other hand, this quite radical protest theater of the 60s and 70s.
I have a friend who's actually like a company member with the Living Theater now.
Wow.
And he's like totally obsessed with Piscator. And I was always like, okay, sure, Piscator, whatever. But so did Judith Malita actually study with Piscator at the New School? Were you able to find that out? Or?
Yeah, she did. He was not super supportive of her. She began as an acting student, I believe, and wanted to switch over to directing. And, you know, he sort of told her no on certain terms that he didn't, you know, women weren't directors. Mm. But at the same time, she did make that switch. And there a few years ago, there was her notebooks from her time at the Dramatic Theater were published. And you do see what a profound impact he had on her. Another person who has passed since, but who I interviewed for the book, is Rachel Rosenthal, who is a feminist performance artist who had worked very closely with Brecht as an assistant director on one of the productions that I studied, and also, you know, had his work was a really formative influence on her.
With Brecht or with Piscator?
Oh, sorry, with Piscator. Yeah, okay. Did I say Brecht?
Yeah, you said, I think you said Brecht, but
She was working with Piscator.
Wow, that's fascinating. I get the sense, reading the chapter on Piscator, that one big difference between Piscator and Brecht is that while Brecht has this sort of very canny sense of irony, Piscator is sort of much more kind of open-hearted and sincere. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that Piscator is earnest in a sense. I also think Piscator is not a theorist, right? So Piscator, his book that comes close to giving a theory of his theater, which is called The Political Theater, is actually really just basically a collection of press clippings and program notes. He doesn't... he's not a theorist in the way that that Brecht is a theorist. I think he's just very much someone who's trying to do something on stage and is willing to throw out whatever ideologies or convictions about theater he had subscribed to, depending on the context. And I think Brecht was very concerned, to go back to one of the things that you brought up before, very concerned with creating this foundation of a type of theater that would continue after his death.
Yeah. You read a lot about Piscator's production of Peter Weiss's The Investigation, which you say was meant to be a criticism of the Auschwitz trials. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's fascinating. I've read the play and I had not known that it was meant to be a critical of the Auschwitz trials. What was his criticism and how is that meant to be evident in the play?
So there were a few types of criticism, and The Investigation was actually written as the trial was going on. So I believe that the trial hadn't finished when Peter Weiss finished the script, but had finished when Piscator staged it. So that's kind of fascinating. But there were a few types of criticism. The first was that the survivors who were brought to testify were, I think, from everything that I've read, treated quite disrespectfully. There were briefs to the court from the defense saying that because the survivors who were testifying were foreign, their word couldn't be trusted, their testimony couldn't be trusted in the same way that witnesses for the defense who were, you know, Germans could be trusted. Throughout the entire trial, the defendant sort of put on a show of just being very dismissive of the charges against them. The sentences that came down were incredibly light. These were men who really more or less got away with perpetrating mass murder. So I think that there was a lot to criticize in there. And I think for many critics of these trials, it was just an example of West Germany trying to do something maybe more for PR purposes than mm-hmm. anything else. These men had been able to live openly in West Germany, building successful businesses with often looted money. And for Vice, also even more so than the individual defendants, Vice as a leftist was primarily also concerned with the role of German industry in the Holocaust, the sort of the benefits and labor that they got from this whole system of both slavery and mass murder. And so Vice also wanted to make very explicit the sort of the connection between Nazism and capitalism as it continued to exist in West Germany in the 1960s.
Yeah, so
as it just continues to exist, I guess I should say. Sure. But that was his context.
So that's sort of the kind of Brecht's analysis of the Nazis as fundamentally about capitalism.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting. I do think that Vice adds to that quite movingly. I think that this is where he and Piscator sort of make a good team, is that both of them do have this leftist critique of capitalism, but both of them are also very concerned with anti-Semitism, and for both of them, actually, imperialism, mm-hmm. racism, much more generally, in a way that can't just be explained by class right. on its own. So I think that they do have, to my mind, a richer analysis of what's happening. I will say that for Peter Vice, and one of the things that he was then criticized for was that he was absolutely primarily concerned with linking anti-Semitism in Germany to the various anti-colonial struggles in the world, right? And so linking the sort of racist logic of imperialism to the Nazi regime. And there was pushback on that, saying, you know, these things are quite different. But yeah, that was his analysis.
Yeah. Which that seems like a, you know, prophetic or even obvious analysis now, that of course imperialism mm-hmm. is connected with the Holocaust. I wanted to ask you, were you following all the recent controversy over the production of the investigation in New York?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. So this was really fascinating. So there was I think I'm getting all the facts here right, but there was a co-production with Theater of War and the Yiddish Theater Volksbühne of the investigation. Mm-hmm. And Theater of War, you know, does these kind of shortened versions of plays and then has a long kind of community discussion afterwards. And during the community discussion, some of the actors were drawing parallels between the Holocaust and other forms of oppression and intolerance. And several board members of the Yiddish Theater Volksbühne walked out in protest because they felt like this was minimizing the kind of uniqueness of the Holocaust. And this seems to be a really interesting case study in something you talk about in the book, which is, you know, the ways that doing these plays further and further away from the immediate context of the Holocaust can be really politically messy. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about that, about, you know, is there something, should we be worried about, or should we be careful about kind of redoing the investigation? Is it still a play that's worth doing, or is it so tied to its time of Germany's kind of self-evaluation after the war that it's really more of a museum piece than a sort of piece of the repertory at this point?
That's so fascinating. And I can't believe, I mean, it just, I guess we're all in our own bubbles. I can't believe that I hadn't
I think it was like a pretty limited, I think it was maybe, you know, presented once or twice. Reading the book, I was so, you know, it struck me that this was kind of a perfect contemporary case study of this issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's fascinating because actually it does sort of also sound like history repeating itself. That conversation isn't new. That conversation sounds very much like the condemnations of the investigation that that happened when it first came out. So on the one hand, within Germany, the investigation was sort of predictably condemned by the far right, far right publications.
Yeah, Nazis didn't like it.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
But, you know, also like the maybe like slightly less right than the Nazis. But I think that there was also a lot of criticism of it that came from people who would have thought of themselves as politically centrists, who were saying, oh, well, obviously we know that the Nazis are bad, but that was 20 years ago. And like, certainly we have other things to talk about, and let's not beat a dead horse. And, you know, in one of the op-eds about it, someone wrote, you know, oh, just think about how horrible it would be for a couple of young people to go out on a date and accidentally go and see this play thinking it was a murder mystery, and then, you know, like their whole date would be ruined, right? So there's like a lot of this sort of weird stuff that I think is very familiar in our own way today, of like the way that people might talk about plays or movies that are very explicit in their portrayal and condemnation of racism, where it's like, oh, well, we all know that already. Why do we need to sit here and watch this? So there's that. But now to get to this controversy, there was also a lot of condemnation of the play amongst scholars in the U.S., particularly sort of Holocaust studies scholars. Eli Wiesel himself wrote about it. And the criticism there, I think, was that the identity of the victims as Jews was effaced in order to turn the play into a more convincing analogy to think about other cases of oppression. So within the play, Piszkatur actually doesn't use the word Jew. He also doesn't, and this is different, but he also doesn't use the word German. He doesn't really use proper nouns. He does refer with names to some of the characters, so it becomes clear that they're Jewish. To me, what's interesting here, I mean, and this, I don't want to get too much into the weeds here, but I think that part of that criticism of the play, at least as it happened after the publication of the play, was imagining this play as a text rather than as something that would take place in the theater. So in Piscator's production, for example, Piscator actually worked hard to find Jewish actors to portray the characters and to find actors who were also famous enough that people would have recognized them as Jewish, as people who had had to either be in hiding or who had been refugees during the war. And so even though the word Jew isn't spoken, Piscator was bringing these Jewish people onto the stage, right? And, you know, in 1960s West Germany, that was also a pretty striking move. There wasn't the kind of discourse that we have today about actors and representation and self-representation, right? And so, yeah, I don't, obviously, right, not yeah. having seen this, sure, the sure. production that you're talking about, I can't say offhand, but just to say that these debates are ones that keep coming up. And I think that there is this really sort of vexed conversation about trying to come up with different hierarchies of suffering, right? And trying to figure out how, on the one hand, to, and I believe it's incredibly important to maintain historical specificity if we're going to understand the particulars of of a genocide, or to understand the particulars of how Nazism came to rule Germany, right? I think we do need to be careful of the specifics. We can't just say, oh, and this is just like the Nazis, to talk about anything that we don't like. But on the other hand, it's also incredibly important, right, to think about how we can learn from that history in order to consider new cases of injustice.
It's really striking.
It's a tough line.
Yeah. I mean, you go to great length to point that out, that he really does insist on the specificity of the Jewish experience of the Holocaust, even while in other plays, he, you know, goes to great lengths. Piscator does goes to great lengths to draw those kind of connections, but he doesn't really do that with his staging of the investigation.
Draw the connections? Or?
No, you discuss his production of The Crucible, which I think had like a backdrop that included scenes from other persecution throughout history, yeah. right? But he doesn't do anything like that for the investigation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he doesn't on stage, but they do have a program book, and the program book does actually make all of those connections quite explicit, especially connecting the war crimes of Nazi Germany with America's war crimes in the war in Vietnam.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being on the show. I think I just want to say one thing about your book, which is that I think so often books that are about plays either just treat them like they're a text, like any other type of text, or are just concerned with kind of theater as performance and don't really do the close textual readings that you do. So I think your book is a really great example of how you can kind of really appreciate the dual nature of theater, that there is a text that you can study and analyze as a literary work, but that you also have to take into account how it was staged and performed in the historical context.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and be sure to let me know next time you have a book. I'd love to have you back on the show.
Oh, I'd really love that. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak to me. And if anyone out there has made it all the way to the end of this podcast, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Before we go, can we have a little preview? I don't know if you've had time to even start thinking about next projects, but could you tell us a little bit about what you might be working on next?
Yeah, well, I'm actually thinking a lot about podcasts these days. And in some ways, that's sort of the fundamental question of this book Staged is about what sort of public space theater is and can be. And in my next project, I'm interested in thinking about radio and podcasts actually in the same terms. What are the ways that radio creates particular types of public spaces?
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. Well, we'll have to have you back on the show when that project comes out. Once again,
Thank you so much.
The book is Stage, Show Trials, Political Theater, and the Aesthetics of Judgment. Be sure to check it out.